give people 10 minutes to get things rolling, finish up the government stuff. Hopefully people come, so they can go. All right, so we were covering the heads of the executive branch. We did the governor, we did the lieutenant governor. Next up is the aforementioned council, which we talked a lot about on Thursday. The governor's council is made up of 11 elected officials plus the lieutenant governor. Massachusetts is only one of two states that has a governor's council. The other is New Hampshire. The primary purpose of the governor's council is to be a check and balance on executive authority. That's what it states in the Constitution. Many of the executive actions of the governor must be done with the advice of the council. In other words, you have to get a majority vote. 5 of the 9 have to approve when the governor does certain things, and we'll go through the list. Now, in order to be eligible to serve on the Massachusetts Governor's Council, you have to be a Massachusetts resident today for 5 years. They are elected and serve 2-year terms. And their constituency are made up of 5 contiguous counties. 5 contiguous Senate districts. That's what it is. Not counties, Senate districts. So we have 40 senators. Our state map is divided up into 40 districts to elect senators. Well, you put 5 that are contiguous, meaning they touch 5 together, and that's where you get the district for governor's council. Now, as I said, the primary job of the governor's council is to be a check on the governor. Again, it would be pretty stupid if Massachusetts, which started the war for independence, rebelling against executive tyranny, would allow an all-powerful government, an all-powerful executive. But if you recall, going all the way back to the foundation, the very first charter of 1629, the governor basically enacted the laws with the assistance. The council is a historical legacy of that reality. Now, whereas under the original charter, the assistants could actually go out and do things, they had power. When the province charter came in 1691, that's when the Council of Assistants shifted to be an advisory board. And that's the way it has been. Originally, the Council of Assistants worked with the General Court and helped them pass laws. Whereas after the provincial charter, then they worked with the governor to help the governor govern. That makes sense. All right. Under the Constitution, as it still is today, there are specific executive actions that the council must give their advice on, or their consent. 1, appointment of all court officers. The appointment of all court officers. So anyone who has quasi-judicial power. 2, we're talking justices of the peace, notary publics, judges, anyone that has quasi-judicial functions or anyone that's an officer of the courts. Why? Well, the power of the court system is to make judgments under the law. You know, it's the job of the executive branch to enforce the law. Well, did the executive branch enforce the law correctly? Well, again, it's part of our system of checks and balances. Well, if the governor is going to spend any money, the council has to sign off on it. All bills are paid on legal documents called warrants. So every bill is listed on a document. The council reviews the warrants and they approve all spending. Next, pardons. I mentioned this when I was talking about the governors. You know what a pardon is, right? What's a pardon? Well, it's not just the president, the governor can do it too. Releases them from where? From prison, yeah. So you went to court, you were convicted of a crime, found guilty. Well, the governor, just like the president, has the authority to commute your sentence, end it early, or completely pardon you. Basically, wipe the record clean. Well, in order for the governor to give a pardon, you have to get 5 votes in the governor's court. Council has to approve. And lastly, if the governor wants to adjourn the general court, wants to end a session, or prorogue it, postpone it, the governor can only do that with the advice of the council. Questions? All right. Next executive officer is the Secretary of the Commonwealth. Secretary of the Commonwealth. Current Secretary of the Commonwealth is Bill Galvin. He's been in office, God, in the early 1990s. I'm actually shocked he's running for re-election. He said he's doing one more term. The primary task, according to the Constitution, of the Secretary is to keep all official records. Every department report, every election return, be it for state or local elections, every appointment made by the governor, every original act by the general court has to be recorded and archived. That's done by the Secretary of the Commonwealth's Department. That's what it says in the Constitution. But since the Constitution was ratified, by statute, they've also added other records that have to be recorded. Every child who is born in Massachusetts, their birth certificate gets recorded by the state. Every person who dies in Massachusetts, their death certificate gets recorded. Every business that's chartered or incorporated gets recorded. Any census that is taken, all are recorded and archived. By the way, the biggest state building is One Ashburton Place. If you ever look at a picture of Boston and you look at on Beacon Hill where the State House is, the Golden Dome, to the right is a big tower that you can see in all the pictures. It actually is bigger than it looks if you look at a picture from like the Common, because One Ashburton Place sits, the ground floor is lower than the State House. but it's a huge skyscraper building, and that's where all of the documents are kept. The Secretary's office is also responsible for publishing the Mass General Laws, the MGLs. Any public documentation. One of my favorite things that comes out of the Secretary's office is before elections. Every house in Massachusetts gets a little red book that tries to explain all of the ballot questions. So that way you know you can have an informed vote. Questions? Today, people have a right to directly vote for the Secretary of the Commonwealth. It's an elective office. And it serves coterminously with the governor and the lieutenant governor. Meaning, 4-year term, elected during the midterm elections. So 2026 is an election year. We have a chance to vote on Secretary of the Commonwealth. Of course, we know he's second in the line of succession behind the Lieutenant Governor. And lastly, secretaries do have administrative powers. They can hire all of their staff. The governor cannot hire the secretary staff. The secretary can, though. So all of the assistant secretaries, deputies, all of the people that work in that department are hired by the secretary. Questions? All right. Next up is the Attorney General. Current Attorney General is Andrea Campbell. Job of the AG is to be the Chief Legal Officer for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. In theory, she is supposed to represent us in all litigation, all lawsuits involving either the Commonwealth or the different departments of the Commonwealth. Now, does she actually go into trial? No. There are assistant AGs that do all that work. The AG is third in line, as we know, in the line of succession. Like all of the other executive officers, elected coterminously with the governor, 4-year terms. But one of the most important jobs that the AG has is they can, if asked, provide legal advice. So, if something happens to you, say you buy a product and you get harmed by the product and you try working with the manufacturer to get some type of remedy, but they're unresponsive. Any citizen has the right to call the Attorney General's office and ask for legal advice. Towns, cities, the different government agencies, they all have the ability to contact the AG's office and ask legal questions. And if the Attorney General certifies an action, the AG certification has the same power as a court decision. So, the governor, Maura Healey, has threatened and has enacted lawsuits against towns that haven't passed the MBTA Communities Act. There was a question over the constitutionality of that. Well, Attorney General Campbell reviewed the situation and she had no problem with what the governor was doing.
So as a result, the majority of the cities and towns essentially bent the knee to the will of the governor.
Very powerful position. Like the secretary, lastly, Attorney General also can appoint all of their staff.
Questions? All right, next up is the Treasurer and Receiver General. Current Treasurer and Receiver General is Deb Goldberg. The job of the Treasurer is to hold all of the money. Every single tax dollar comes in goes to her office. Every type of state investment goes out of her office. Every disbursement for payment goes out of her office. Only the treasurer is authorized to use state funds to make payments.
So, if a bill has to be paid, the governor sends the warrant to the governor's council. The governor's council determines if it's going to get paid or not. Ultimately, the check is cut by the treasurer.
The treasurer's office also supervises the collection of town taxes.
Every single year, our treasurer collector in Sutton has to send a report to the state treasurer's office, showing every single dollar that came in, every dollar that was spent. Treasurer's office reviews it and certifies it if it looks correct.
The treasurer's office manages the lottery.
FYI, we have one of the worst lotteries in the whole country. If you are, or anyone in your family likes buying those scratch tickets, Massachusetts pays out roughly 50 cents per dollar. Most states around 60 to 70 cents per dollar.
So the best way to win, don't buy Massachusetts scratch tickets. Like all the other positions, elected coterminously with the governor. 4-year term. And like the other three on this page, they can appoint and hire their deputies.
The last of the 14 executive officers in Massachusetts is the auditor. Unlike all of the other ones, which were created by the Constitution, the auditor was created by statute.
The auditor's office was made in, I think it was like 1848 or something like that.
Why? Well, there was a concern of potential corruption.
There was a concern that our monies were not being spent in accordance to the law.
So, the general court passed a law that basically said we should have one neutral person that has the authority to look at the books.
They have authority, or this office, currently held by Diana DiZoglio,
they have the authority, statutorily, to review the books for any branch, any department, any office in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts,
even down to the municipal level.
The sole job is to authenticate the money that comes in and the money that goes out.
Essentially, what the auditor has to do is they have to review every single transaction.
Anything comes in and goes out and determine its legality.
Now, here's the thing.
For years, the auditor was allowed to do their job. But over the last 30 years, the general court has not allowed the state auditor to review their books. Ultimately, that's what led to the ballot question on the last election. That 72% of the people said the auditor should be able to look at the general court's books. Again, our state budget is going to be $63 billion. We are $128 billion in debt. Where's the money? Where's it going?
So that is one of the biggest controversial legal issues that's ongoing in our state right now, even though the media is not talking about it.
Because every department that she's audited so far, she has found waste and corruption. So if she's actually able to get into the book, and the irony was that Diana was actually a state rep for 8 years. She knows what's going on there.
So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that the people of Massachusetts put enough pressure onto their representatives to have the will of the people be followed. She is the fifth in line for the governor's gig, and of course she's elected coterminously.
And last but not least, she gets to appoint her staff.
And by the way, we are
one of the few states that the overwhelming majority of our executive officers are women. FYI. Questions?
All right, well, people that are here, the ones that do the homework. So why don't we see if we can bang this out before we start the courts.
Yes?
I just sent it to you. I didn't know your school would
be there. Nice. Okay. Yes, if you have it digital, now is the time to send it to me. Unless somebody, like somebody, sends it to me, like Oprah Beaver. All right, here we go. What is the Supreme Executive Magistrate officially called in Massachusetts? What do we call that position? Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That's their official title. Very good. Well, actually, if you're going to address them, what is the official title?
His Excellency.
His Excellency. Now, by the way, that's actually what the Constitution says. So if you ever come across Maura Healey, constitutionally speaking, you must call her His Excellency. All right. We know now that in order to be governor of Massachusetts, you have to be living in the state for 7 years. You have to be a registered voter. But what were the original qualifications to be governor?
Well,
Have to be here for 7 years. Must have. Oh, you had to be a Christian. Anything else? You must have land that's worth £1,000. £1,000. FYI, that is about 500 or 600 acres of land. You had to have big property. Why do you think they wanted the governor to have big property? Why do you think that it was important enough that John Adams put it in the Constitution that the governor must be this big landowner? Any guess? That's true, yeah. Because you can't get lots of land if you are not successful. And don't you want someone who's successful running the state? Also, if you have lots of land, what do you do? Have to do? You have to pay taxes. So we talked about this before, about the property qualification. The Founding Father, their generation, believed strongly that if you own land and you pay property taxes, that showed you were contributing to the well-being of society. They didn't want any freeloaders serving an elector of office. Again, there's that morality component. You had to be a Christian. Anything else? I think that's the big ones. I think those are the big four. Land, 7-year term, have to be a Christian. Register to vote. All right. Who was allowed to vote for the candidates running for governor? Who may vote for governor? Anyone find that?
This is qualified voters from the Commonwealth, which were originally white male property holders.
Okay. White wasn't a requirement, believe it or not. No, it wasn't a requirement, no. But the overwhelming majority of people that were free men at the time were happened to be from Europe. Maybe. But yes, you had to own land. You had to own 60 pounds worth of land. And you, of course, had to be a member of the church, which means you could not engage in shenanigans. And you have to, of course, reside in the town that you vote for. All right, good. Here's an interesting one. What happens if no candidate receives a majority of votes in the election? What happens if nobody wins a majority? What's the mechanism in the Constitution? Anyone find this?
Looks like the general court chooses the governor from the top candidates.
Top two candidates. Their names go to the general court, and the general court decides. Very good. By a majority vote, by the way, FYI. All right. Well, the governor has authority to call together the council. Ooh, we covered this in class. What are the major executive actions that require the advice of the council? Appointments. Pardons.
Official power decision? I put executive decision between the official powers.
Yeah, but what decisions in particular? So we got appointments. We got pardons.
Bills.
What?
Bills.
Bills. Paying the bills. And there was one other broad area. If the general court is not behaving, they can adjourn. Very good. All right. The governor is the commander-in-chief of all military forces of the state. What authority does the governor have over the militia? What can the governor do? Well, let's think about it from a military perspective. If an army invades Massachusetts, what do you think the governor can do? Yeah, it can muster them, they can call forth the militia. Can send forth the troops. Who's going to lead the troops on the battlefield? You think it's going to be the governor? Who's going to lead the troops? The governor technically is the commander-in-chief. Who's the command, who's on command of the battlefield? Officers. Generals. Commanding officers. Governor has the power to appoint commanding officers. Both the land forces and the Navy. Question. Actually, no, that's the next one. All right, so we got that one. What can the governor not do as commander-in-chief?
Declare war independently? You can't go against the state laws.
Can't violate, can't go against the Constitution, can't go against state law. Can't declare war. Well, that's that limitation, I'll give you that one, because that's imposed by the U.S. Constitution. States can't declare war. But it's a very interesting thing. The purpose of the Massachusetts militia is to do what? The people where? In Massachusetts. One of the most interesting clauses in the Constitution is it clearly states that the governor doesn't have the authority to send troops out of the state. So, by our Constitution, the governor cannot invade Rhode Island because the Massachusetts militia must stay in Massachusetts. Now, in our modern system, who has the authority to call Massachusetts troops out of the state? Who's the big commander-in-chief? President. So the governor cannot order the troops out, but the President of the United States can call our modern militia, which is the National Guard, out of the state. For national purposes.
Is that the only one they can call out? National Guard?
Well, the reserves and... Well, the reserves are technically part of the National Army anyways. But yeah, the... Now, here's the interesting thing. Technically, militias are not outlawed. Towns do still have the legal authority to muster their residents. But the President of the United States could not order a group of town militia out of the state. They only can do it with the National Guard. All right. What must the governor do to ensure that the Commonwealth is military ready at all times? They're required to do training. what also a taxpayer is supposed to pay for. Yeah, they're weapons, they're equipment. It's a constitutional requirement. Governor is supposed to make sure that there are accessible weaponry paid for by taxpayer money, so that way the soldiers can fight. Now here's the interesting thing. Back then, everybody had their own guns. So the bulk of the money that was spent was for what the guns fired. Gunpowder and shot. The equivalent of modern bullets. Today, it would be difficult for Massachusetts to do that because the citizens have so many different type of weapons. There's no standard. Like back then, everyone basically fired a musket. And all the musket barrels were basically the same. So they all basically fired the same ball. But nowadays, you know, different weapons fire different types of ammunition. Heck, I think in my collection, if I was to try to fire at all of my firearms in a given day, I think I would need 12 or 13 or 14 different types of ammunition. You know, I got 22s, I got 9mm, I got 40 Smith & Wessons, I got 223, I got 7.62x39, I got 7.62x551, just, I got an 8mm, you know, 30-06. Alright, here we go. What's the check established in the Constitution to ensure that the governor will not fall under undue influence of the general court? Anyone get this one? This is probably the hardest governor's question of them all. You have to read into one of the clauses to make sense of this question. Constitution literally calls for separation of powers. The Constitution states the governor shall act independently. All right, questions? All right. Part of the second chapter 2, section 2. What is the official title of the lieutenant governor? What do we refer to the lieutenant governor? What is the honorary title? His honor. All right, there you go. What gave it away? Alright, what are the qualifications to serve as lieutenant governor?
Same as the governor.
Easy answer. Same as the governor. Alright, what happens if no person receives a majority of votes in the election for the lieutenant governor?
They can choose from like any other
top. Who's they? Who chooses? Who chooses?
The general court.
General court does. Yep, legislature chooses. Top two. All right. What are the only two constitutional responsibilities of the lieutenant governor? There's only two things in there that said that were the jobs of the lieutenant governor. They have to sit on the council, and they have to
just in case the governor like dies or something happens.
Yeah, the Constitution says their primary job is to be the next in line. Alright, any questions on these? Part of the second chapter 2, section 3. How many members make up the governor's council? Technically 9, right? The lieutenant governor plus 8. All right? What is the required quorum in order for the Governor's Council to do business?
5 out of 9.
It has to be a majority. 5 out of 9. Yep. How were members of the council originally? Oh, I forgot a word. To gain their position. They weren't originally elected by the people. How did one originally become a member of the Governor's Council? No. Kind of. From where? And how?
Elected by the people.
For what office? They weren't originally elected by the people directly. They got into their office indirectly. But what did they have to run for before they could become a member of the council? They had to be elected as a potential senator. Then the Senate picked 8 of their own. And those 8 served on the governor's council. So originally, the people elected 48 senators. 40 of them stayed in the Senate, 8 went on to the governor's council. All right, in the hierarchy of authority, where do the members of the council rank? It states it in the Constitution. Anyone find this one?
Directly below the governor?
Yeah, directly below. Technically the governor and lieutenant governor, but yeah. So technically the council is above all of the other executive officers. And last but not least, besides giving the advice to the aforementioned executive actions, what other constitutional responsibility is assigned to the council?
One other job that they're supposed to engage in. Did anyone find it? Clause number, chapter 1, executive power, article, chapter 2, section 3, lieutenant governor of the council.
Article 6. Whenever the office of the governor and lieutenant governor shall be vacant by reason of death, absence, or otherwise, then the council, or the major part of them, shall during such vacancy have full power to do and execute all and every such acts, matters, and things as the governor or the lieutenant governor might or could, by virtue of this constitution, do or execute. If they, or either of them, were personally present. Originally, before the law was changed that lined up the executive officers, if both the governor and lieutenant governor ceased to be, the governor's council would take over. They originally were the next in line. Did anyone get that? All right, last one. The Constitution, as I said, did not originally name the auditor. That was added by statute. But they did give recognition to other constitutional officers. Secretary, Treasurer, Receiver General, the Commissary General. By the way, Commissary General,
This is the head of the National Guard. Notary publics, naval officers. Originally, how did these other officers get their job? They were not elected. How did they get into office? Were they appointed by the governor?
I vote with consent of the council.
Notaries public? Not original. Originally, Secretary of Treasury, Receiver General, Commissary General, Notaries Publics, and Naval Officers were appointed by a vote of the General Court. So the General Court elected them. Originally, notary publics would eventually go over to the domain of the council, treasurer, secretary, they would be elected, commissary general would eventually be appointed by the governor, and naval officers. All right, what check was put into the Constitution to protect the people's money? There was a check put in there. This was an interesting thing. What happens if you're on the job too long and you're surrounded by lots and lots of money? What could happen to you? You could become corrupt. One of the most interesting things that I stumbled upon was a simple clause to make sure that the treasurer does not become corrupt. They are term limited. What is the maximum number of years that they can serve in that job? It's the only position that is term limited.
Five?
They only can serve 5 years. That's it. You can go on and do other jobs, but you only can be treasurer for 5 years. And last but not least, the only other reference, what was the constitutional responsibility of the secretary? The job is still the same. What is the job of the Secretary of the Commonwealth? The keeper of the records. All right, perfect. Any questions on this? All right, that was the last lengthy one. Nice job. Nice job. So with the time that we have left, I'm going to start the last branch, judiciary branch. All right. The judiciary refers to our court system. And our court systems in this country are based upon English common law. We inherited our system from the mother country. Common law is a body of law that literally were made by judges in England going all the way back to 1066 AD. Does anyone know what happened in 1066 AD in England? England literally was conquered. Prior to 1066, England comprised of several small Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. The Vikings did invade at one point, and they carved out a chunk of it as well.
But in 1066,
the Duke of Normandy, William, sailed across the English Channel, met the English at the Battle of Hastings, and killed their king, took his crown, and declared himself to be the new King of England. The Normans were from France, but they were the descendants of another group of Vikings.
Did any of you ever watch, it's now like on Netflix, I think, the History Channel had it on about 10 years ago. It's called The Vikings. No, it was a good series. It talked about Ragnar? I don't remember the Viking. Actually, it was based on a true story, but it was, of course, Hollywood shit.
But the primary character's brother, a Viking by the name of Rollo, conquered Normandy, which is the peninsula of France, which is at the southern area of England. He was made a noble, and eventually his descendants would invade England. Well, when King William conquered the island, which is the reason why history refers to him as William the Conqueror, he ordered all of the judges. He didn't kill them all. He didn't replace them all. He allowed the Anglo-Saxon judges to remain. But he ordered them all to enforce the king's law. And he sent out government officials to go to the different towns to review the decisions made by judges and made sure they were consistent with the law. So to put it another way, no matter where in England you went, you would get the same type of outcome. No matter who you were, whether you were a peasant or you were a noble, you got the same basic outcome. That all of the decisions were made in common. Eventually, there was a later order by William's great-great-grandson, Henry II, that all of the judges write down their decisions. So not only do they have to enforce the king's law, but they have to actually document the facts of the case that was before them and what they decided. Because what would happen is future courts would look to that decision as a guide on how to make a decision in a future case. That process is known as stare decisis. What? Stare decisis. Do you know what it means?
Just stand by a decision.
Stand by what's decided. Case in point.
Back in 1315, there was a deal made where a guy made an agreement with a quote-unquote doctor to cure his failing eyesight. Unfortunately, the treatment that was used did in fact not cure the poor man's eyesight, and instead he went blind. Because the herbs that were mixed up in the concoction was probably resulting in something like arsenic. The man sued. What do you think the outcome was?
did the doctor have to pay? What would happen if you went to a doctor today? And you were blinded. Would the doctor have to pay? What?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because of insurance, right?
Well, the doctor has insurance. You have insurance. Do you know what would end up happening? The court would look at the best practices. The court would say, okay, what is the outcome of similar treatment? Did the doctor do something that was so out of line with medical standards? Because just because you go to the doctor, does that mean 100% you're going to get a cure? No. Ironically, the poor blind guy lost. Because what did the doctor agree to do? He agreed to try to help get his eyesight better. And it was found the doctor followed through on his promise. He met with him. He provided the salve or the drops. He did his best based upon medical standards of the day. Because when you go to the doctors, to a degree, it's at your own risk. That case, 1315, it's called the Oculus case. I learned that case when I went to law school. That case essentially established the precedent, the standard, for medical malpractice today. That's stare decisis. So the court will look to decisions that were made in the past and they'll try to make similar rulings. So that way you could have consistency, predictability,
and objectivity. There are standards. Well, you may know this or you may not, but the vast majority of our founding fathers, they were all lawyers. John Adams, lawyer, one of the most famous attorneys in Massachusetts. Thomas Jefferson, lawyer. James Madison, lawyer. John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, lawyers. When our founding fathers made our country, we already had common law here, based on stare decisis. Because we were English. So all they did was basically make our American judicial system based upon that foundation. So, whether it's federal courts or it's state courts, most of our court systems do just that. You go into the court, you present your evidence, the other side gets to present their evidence, and then before the court makes a decision, it will look to see, are there any other cases that have ever happened, that deal with similar circumstances? So for example, think of how many incidents happen in Massachusetts where there's a car accident because someone was texting on their phone. Because there's so many, it's really easy to do. Chances are, if you're the person who was texting, A, that's a violation of state law, but B, the court's going to impose the same type of penalty if I was the person who got in an accident that was texting and driving. Why? Because they look to the past. They look to the standards. They stand on what has been decided.
Questions?
All right. This will be the last little chunk and then we'll call it a class.
So where do the courts look? As guides.
when they make their decisions. Because remember, that's the whole purpose of our system. Our courts make judgments under the law. They apply the law to real life situations and they make decisions. Well, the first place they look are the constitutions. If it's a federal court, they look to the U.S. Constitution. If it's a state court, they look to the state constitution. The constitutions are the biggest, most important sources of law in our civil system, in our republic. What is the purpose of a constitution? What literally is the purpose of the Constitution? Why do we have constitutions?
To benefit the people.
How? No. Constitutions do not give you rights. What?
There's a guide.
Guide to who? Who? No. You're right, it's a guide. But the guide to who? Or what?
A government.
To do what?
To govern us correctly, because we chose them.
The purpose of the Constitution is to tell the government what it can and cannot do. That's why I had you read everything through. What can the government do to you? We went through the legislature branch, all the powers that it has. We went through the executive branch, all the powers they have. Those are the things that they can do. And guess what happens if the Constitution doesn't give those powers to the government? Can the government do it? No. So going back to your earlier point about giving rights, no. What the Constitution says is there are things that the government cannot do to us. They cannot interfere with our religion. They cannot interfere with our speech. They cannot interfere with our association. They cannot stop us from owning guns, etc., etc. It's like the Ten Commandments for the government. The government shall not. So the courts are going to look to the Constitution to see if the law itself is constitutional. Because if the government passes a law that they're trying to punish you under, and the law is unconstitutional, government has no right to punish you. As I've already said, the courts will look to the record, the legal process of the judiciary system itself. Interestingly enough, major cases that are decided in Massachusetts, the other states, even the U.S. Supreme Court, there are frequently references to cases that were decided in England hundreds of years ago. Because those were decisions that were made by judges that all future judges are obligated to adhere to. They also look at the outcomes, the case law. It's funny, when you go to law school, you don't go to learn how to be a lawyer. You go to law school and they train you how to read the cases. Because lawyers can only do what it says in the cases. So you spend a lot, I mean literally, you buy books. My biggest book was my torts book. I think it was 1,200 pages. It had case after case after case after case. What were the facts? What law did the judge apply? How did the case decide? The court decide? The last area, statutes. If our legislative bodies pass a law called a statute, that will be applied by the courts. So,
you do not have a right to drink and drive, because Massachusetts passed a law that says if you blow anything over a .08, I think, on a breathalyzer, you are considered operating under the influence, and you'll be subject to criminal penalty. Massachusetts says you have to be at least 16 years old to get a driver's permit. You have to be 16 and a half. If you did driver's ed, you get a driver's license. Massachusetts says on most roads, it's posted at 55 miles an hour. All of those are laws that were passed by the legislature. So if you commit a crime, by the way, you do not have a right to commit a crime. But if the government accuses you of wrongdoing, committing a crime, you're going to be punished under what the law says, unless the law is unconstitutional.
All right, we will stop it there and we will pick up on Thursday. So Thursday, I think there's only like 6 questions. You know, the judiciary questions, make sure you bang that out, because the judiciary section is actually really short, surprisingly so. If you have your hard copies, I'll take your hard copies. And just a reminder, if you are going to do early submission for your paper, it's due this week. If you drop your paper in the drop box, I think I said I'd add 10 points.
The grades were the test.
I clicked like 5 buttons. I hate this system.
It's like 9 minutes.